This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Caribbean Studies. This is a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Zach Myers, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Andal Gosain about his new book, Nature's Wild, Love, Sex, and Law in the Caribbean. Andal, welcome to the show.
Hi, Zach. Really nice for you to have me here. Thanks.
It's lovely to have you here, too. So I thought we could just begin by if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, especially because in the book, there's so much fascinating material about your personal relationship to the topics in the book. I thought it would be a great place for us to just start by giving us a bit about you.
Sure. Well, right now, I'm a professor in environmental arts and justice at York University in Toronto, Canada. I grew up in Trinidad. I lived there until I was 14 years old, almost 15. And then my family moved to Canada. And then I finished high school there, did my undergrad, and then began my grad studies in the UK. And then lived in France for a number of years while doing my PhD. And and then I returned to Canada eventually to teach at the university where I teach now. I'm an academic primarily, but for the last 15 years, I've also been doing artistic curatorial work. And so the book is very much a kind of intersection of both my biography and these multiple disciplinary interests.
Cool. I thought that was a really fascinating part of the book, actually. I think it's really nice to have academic books that really draw from personal and also artistic experience. I think it makes for something a bit more interesting. So I thought we could now just talk a little bit about how you came to the specific topic of the cover of the books now and how you kind of came to this book in particular.
Yeah. You know, in many ways, the book emerged. I didn't really make a plan to write a book like this. I think around the time, you know, I think what really kind of served as the catalyst is that I had been asked to blurb a couple of things and, you know, people who were referencing my earlier work and I hadn't written a book. And I thought, well, you know, why haven't I kind of pulled the work I've done together? A lot of academics focus on a book when they when they prepare their tenure files or they're working toward tenure. And I'd always liked the essay form, so I'd always sort of written lots and lots of essays. And at the time, you know, I thought, you know, maybe I should pull my essays together. And in the process of doing that, this whole other project emerged where some of it was based on previous work, but really I had arrived at a moment that I wanted to underline the space I was in and the kinds of new observations I was making. So in many ways, the book is 15 years in the making, I would say, because it's perhaps 15 years before it when I got interested in sexuality and development first, and then, of course, sexuality rights. And then, you know, the book kind of then leads you into artistic practice, which was then a kind of a more relatively new endeavor. I really hadn't been making any artwork until 2011. And it much like the book, it was something that just emerged in a context where I felt I had to make art without any kind of professional plan. So in many ways, when, and the book was written fairly quickly, like I think it was maybe 18 months from beginning to end of the process and of the actual writing. And I think it was very much just capturing the moment I was in, the kinds of new observations that I felt I had started noticing, or and then of course I had this body of research to draw on from my work as an academic. So it was really the culmination of all of this that produced the book, and it was great that the press was enthusiastic about taking it on, and then the book came out pretty quickly.
Cool. So I think just to get into the meat of the book now, I thought we could segue that way. So one of the things I think, which is that the feature of the book is how it unpicks the way that the politics of the human-animal divide in the Caribbean is kind of factored or undercut or cut through with a lot of the discourses around sexuality. So I was wondering if you could just kind of go through the basis of the argument, which I think is what really underpins the book's framework, and just walk us through that as a bit of an introduction.
Absolutely. Like, that's the central contention or concern in the book, is what does that dividing line between human and animal do? What has it done, particularly since the dawn of colonization? The kind of seed of this idea is really the work of a feminist artist named Lorraine O'Grady, whose parents were Jamaican, and then they moved to Boston in the 1930s, and she became a quite renowned feminist artist. She had a solo exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum last year. But I had met Lorraine and interviewed Lorraine while she was working on one of her pieces named Landscape Western Hemisphere. And in this interview, she had talked to me about, you know, we had this very great conversation. What brought us together, what work I had been doing on queer ecology, and she became interested in my work. And she invited me to visit her studio, and I became very intrigued with her work. And so we had this dialogue in 2011, it was 2011. In 2011, that in which she talked about, you know, sex being the place in which we can't hide our animality. And for me, it set off a different way of thinking about desire that, you know, may be quite obvious, but I think is overlooked in a lot of the scholarship on sexuality in the Caribbean. Up to that point, I really was quite immersed and a big part of many conversations about sexuality rights in the Caribbean. In 2007, I had organized with Tracy Robinson in Barbados the first kind of major gathering of academics and activists working on sexuality rights, and that was in Barbados. And, you know, many of the activists who were at that initial meeting became quite important in their own countries and are quite activist leaders today. So I had been a big part of those conversations, but I felt that we had not really contended with how important sex really was in shaping the development of the Caribbean. So there was a line for me between, you know, Lorraine's kind of short observation about the kinds of work that we do to present ourselves as humans. And in sexuality scholarship, we might think of this as all about all of the work on citizenship. There's a way in which sexuality rights had been predicated on recognition of queer people in particular as citizens. So there was always a kind of aspirational model in which the literature was always making the argument about our humanity. And so, and our, you know, our rights to be citizens. So, and Lorraine was saying something else that intrigued me. And so as I dug in deeper, I recognized and I began to learn how much, not just sexuality rights, but how much of our very organization in the Caribbean was predicated on this kind of colonial demand for colonial subjects to be caught in this trap of always having to prove that they were human, not animal. So if you, you know, you go back to 500 years, you know, the genocide of indigenous people is really premised on this idea that they were less human than European invaders. Slavery, also premised on the idea that African peoples were less human than their enslavers. Indentureship, which I refer to often in the book for a variety of reasons, also premised on the idea that, you know, these folks weren't human either. You know, in the people in the Caribbean call themselves East Indians, which is actually named after the cargo, because that's what they were treated. So there is this long history of hierarchizing people along a line between animal and human, in which, you know, there was a deep kind of racial violence executed at each step. And not only was it happening, you know, through this long period, but you see it particularly in the kind of post-colonial life of the Caribbean, in countries like Trinidad and Jamaica, where you then had the kind of post-colonial elite kind of mimicking this very kind of intention of colonizers to always to make themselves human by producing someone else as less than. You know, invading colonizers were not just interested in producing non-white people as less human for the sake of invasion, but it was also really about reassuring themselves that they were human too, because they were coming from a context in which many of the folks who then became settlers in the New World were placed in the same position of, you know, having to feel like they were producing, they had to produce evidence of their humanity, you know, many from, like, you know, classes that were not, had very little position in Europe, and then, you know, saw the New World as a way in which to acquire social mobility. So you have these at every step, you know, all the ways in which this very important demand that you must prove yourself human, not animal, as a way to secure rights, well-being, a life. And so I began to think through this more deeply through Nature's Wild, and I continue to do so in its aftermath. I felt that in the kind of current debates and actions around sexuality rights, there wasn't enough attention being paid to just how important the subconscious desire held up everything else in the battle of the belly representing our subconscious, unconscious desires, and the brain, the things we intend. You know, the belly tends to win. And I think we need to really appreciate the significance of desire in a way that I think we're not yet close to doing.
So on that note, actually, I wanted to ask you a question about how the law factors into the way that you frame the book, because I think it's interesting that you spend a lot of time thinking about law, because on one hand, it feels as though it's the arena whereby claims towards rights and the discourses around citizenship that you've kind of problematized here play themselves out. But it's also this kind of area in which this desire, the belly, as you say, is kind of regulated in an interesting way. And I thought a lot of the time in the book, the places where you would write about law were things that I thought were really interesting. So if you could just kind of give a bit of an overview about how you feel like the law as a thing factors into your
discussion.
What
was really
here.
Interesting to me is that the introduction, of course, all through the Global South, any anti-sodomy laws that were introduced by colonizing European powers. And in the case of the British, you know, it was really interesting, all of these detailed laws, which were about managing the civility of the indigenous people and, you know, enslaved people, indentured people, and so on, that became new colonial subjects. There was this intentionality in the law to kind of manage these populations that were viewed as less than human into making them human. So you had things like dress codes, laws about who people can marry, laws about what they could wear, even, you know, and very, very detailed laws. And they were really I mean, there were two things happening. One way of viewing those laws was about asserting the kind of hierarchy established, that the laws were really intended to justify colonial expansion as a kind of civilization process, to civilize these subjects. But the other thing that sometimes gets overlooked is that these laws were really about colonizing peoples themselves, negotiating their own humanity. Like, there was a way in which these laws were put in place as a kind of response to their own anxieties, their own desires for the other, their own desires, for example, for gay sex. Because you see in colonial records a great deal of anxiety over and over again about the kinds of examples of sexual relationships that settlers would encounter and be alarmed about. And they were alarmed because they were coming from a context in which their own sexualities were deeply disciplined. And so what they did through a series of new laws was the same thing. In the book, there are a few case studies that I call attention to, which involve the application of the law. One of them is in Guyana, where a group of, quote, men dressing like women are arrested in a 19th century law, based on a 19th century law that defines what men and women can wear. And then you see through this very long process, like it's a 10-year case, and eventually the defendants win and the law is thrown out. But, you know, it really is through the whole process, this kind of expression of anxiety, particularly from the people making the law, and then from their attempts to then reproduce those anxieties in the people who are really the subjects of the law. So, you know, it was really important for me to not just think about desire philosophically, but to really... I'm very much a student of Stuart Hall. His influence is so overwhelming. I think that's why he's not even mentioned in the book. It's one of those strange things where it feels like he informs everything. And Hall always felt that the purpose of theorizing and thinking was really to make a difference in politics. So for me, you know, referring to these cases in particular, I was really just interested in, like, what are the practical ways in which this dividing line, or our anxieties about this dividing line between human and animal, operate? What are the implications for people? And so that's also why I turned to those cases.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Just to return to one of the things that you mentioned at the beginning, I think one of the things that I thought was really interesting as a very clear marker of this human-animal divide is sodomy. So I think in the first chapter of the book, you really actually provide a really fascinating history of sodomy and of anti-sodomy laws in the Caribbean. So I thought maybe we could go through a little bit about that. So the first thing I would like to ask is how charges of sodomy were used to justify indigenous genocide in the Caribbean, but then also how these anxieties about homosexuality, or what we might call homosexual sex, were institutionalized later on with the British colonization of the region a
right.
little bit later.
I mean, you know, any kind of deviation from heterosexual marriage was viewed as a kind of deviance and a justification for punishment. And so homosexuality in some ways was not that special. But, you know, it was already something that that had been circulating in the consciousness of Victorian England in particular. So having had anti-sodomy laws be put in place in many ways as a kind of endeavor to racialize and marginalize Irish people. You know, if you read the book, you'll read the story of how a lot of the anxieties of bestiality came from these mythologies of Irish shepherds engaging with sheep that was circulating among the English and therefore used as a kind of justification for anti-Irish sentiment. So people were coming already with a context in which there was a kind of means, a practical means in which sodomy worked as a racializing and marginalizing measure. So to encounter in the Caribbean, across the Americas, any kinds of interpretation of that. And the interpretation is very broad. It didn't actually have to be sodomy, just the suggestion of possibility of it. So, for example, in the book, there are examples of colonizers reading the dress, the wear of indigenous peoples as men dressed in women's clothes. Or clothes that were not suitable for men, or, you know, if there were like arrangements of like physical affection between men. And you could see in a lot of the colonial archives, the way in which the alarm is also a kind of titillation. So you see, you can read through it and see like, people who are at once horrified and mesmerized by deviance, which is just something that I think is part of the human condition, is that to be simultaneously titillated and horrified is something that we find in a lot of the colonial records when it comes to sexuality. And so you have a ready means in which to provide an explanation of inferiority. So sodomy then is held as this thing that's a bestial act. Every single anti-sodomy law in the British Empire, sodomy and bestiality are twinned in the legislation so that they become kind of equal horrors and they become linked back to that kind, those original fears and anxieties in British legislation that in which any these acts become one and the same. And you see it even now, like, you know, when there's a lot of resistance to same-sex marriage, you will hear utterances like, so what, they're going to let people marry animals next? You know, and something that has been really strong in the culture and really kept alive in a really powerful way in which to exercise control and violence against queer people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one question I had about this as well is one thing again throughout the book, which I think is interesting, is you take a lot of care to show how these more colonial logics end up being recapitulated in post-colonial governments in the Caribbean. So specifically maybe with reference to this, how was this kind of carried over into the kind of independence period in, let's say, Trinidad and Tobago?
Yeah, it's really interesting in Trinidad because you have, as anyone knows, wherever there's power, there's always resistance. And you really see that in thinking about the kinds of controls around sexuality in Trinidad, where simultaneous with the upkeep of these laws and the kind of performance of sanctioned heterosexuality, you see lots of spaces in which homosexual desire was exercised, accessible. Lots of scholars have written about carnival being that kind of space, but you also see lots of other ways. So right now I'm researching, one of the subjects of the book is Colin Robinson. And as I'm speaking to you, there's an exhibition around his archives that I've curated in New York. And it's really interesting in his archives to, you know, Colin was born in 1961, a year before Trinidad becomes independent. And Colin was very confident about seeing himself as a young gay man at the age of 13. And he was a prolific writer even as a teenager. And it's really fascinating to see just in those early years of Trinidad becoming an independent nation, how much space there was for Colin to not only see himself as queer, but to be activated enough to like access companionship, to, you know, form crushes, to write poetry about his crushes, to have, you know, rendezvous and then write about it. And this is, you know, just in the early years. So at the same time, so you have that happening where, you know, desire is so powerful, people will find a way in whatever context to exercise them, almost because they can't not exercise them, because it's such a powerful part of our human makeup. But at the same time, there is a very strong sanctioning by the state of, you know, only representing Trinidad as a heterosexual space, as a space in which homosexuality is absent. And you see it, you know, Carnival is a particularly good at this kind of contradiction of presenting itself officially as a kind of place of kind of heterosexual desire, but really it's such a queer space, a space in which sexual boundaries fall apart. But I think what's happening in that post-colonial period, it's almost like the kinds of elites who would then lead those nations like Trinidad felt that the way to reassure their own humanities was to mimic the habits of the colonizer and of the departing colonial class. And part of that was in producing an inferior class. And because it happens in different kinds of intensities. One of the comparisons I make in the book is, I talk a little bit about the work of the artist Christopher Cozier, who grew up in that post-colonial context in the main city of Port of Spain. And, you know, a lot of his work is really, really critical of the ways in which elites mimic colonial practices. And so, you know, he talks about, one of his pieces is about white bread sandwiches, that you could only take what were called, quote, dry sandwiches to school, because that was the proper and civilizing thing to do. Now, me growing up 15 years after Christopher, in the countryside, far away from kind of the gaze of the state, that would have never occurred to me. It was only when I started to go to a school in the city for high school that I was even encountering these deep anxieties about what people could eat, how they could dress, and so on. And so what, you know, why I draw comparison to those differences is really about the exercise of the state's authority, that in the capital might have been where all the resources were, but it was also the kind of place that was most intensely policed. It was a place where one had to police each other. And those kinds of like little villages, which are not important, that don't have, you know, a wealthy class or even a middle class, you know, the formations of identity, of relationships kind of fall out of it. So there are all of these kinds of different experiences happening at the same time, just because of the particularities of different situations. And it was really important for me to, one of the reasons that there's so much autobiography in the book is simply because I really wanted to resist what I felt was also happening in a lot of work on Caribbean sexualities. It was this kind of flattening of the experience of Caribbean people. You know, it tends to be viewed as a relatively small group. But you can see in a small place like Trinidad, there's so many different Trinidads. And of course, desire is so individually wired that you're going to have lots of different kinds of experiences. And it was really important for me to really insist at the outset of thinking about Caribbean people as complex subjects. So on the one hand, you have to, you know, the state isn't in many ways as complex. They have kind of clear, conscious lines about, okay, what is the citizen supposed to be? How are they supposed to behave? What they're supposed to do in life? How do they become productive? How do they contribute to the economy? And that's really, you know, really part of why so much insistence is on the kind of heterosexual model, because it also made sense for the kind of market that was imagined at the time. So, you know, I really want to draw out these complexities, and I guess that's why the book took the directions that it did.
Yeah, I thought that was something that was very interesting, because it's true, you do get a lot of the time focus when it comes to people writing about the Caribbean on these kind of elite urban subjects normally. And so seeing the kind of diversity of Caribbean experience that you have, even when you begin to look outside of the city of Port of Spain, for example, I thought was a really valuable contribution of the book. Just coming back to Colin, actually, so keeping the focus on Trinidad here, moving around a little bit to the third chapter, I thought actually on this note that the pairing of Eric Williams as the father of the nation and Colin as the godfather of the queer movement was a really, really interesting way of thinking about these two figures and thinking about the kind of politics of sexuality in particularly post-colonial Trinidad. So just as like a bit of an introduction, I think many of our listeners probably will know a bit about who Eric Williams is, but if you could just maybe give a bit of context about who Colin Robinson is, and then maybe talk us through a little bit about how you came to that pairing.
Sure. Colin Robinson was a poet actor born in Trinidad in 1961. He was a very precocious young man. I just learned recently that he was reading the newspaper at the age of 3. And by the time he turned 18, he had won the top scholarship in the island, which resulted in a full scholarship to Yale. So in 1980, just before he turns 19, he arrives at Yale with the intention to do a four-year degree, but he drops out in his first term. And in the archives and also in Colin's explanations, you can really see how much the intense racism at Yale was too much for him. You know, he was leaving Trinidad as kind of the shining star and coming to a context in which he was deeply unvalued, not just undervalued, but unvalued as a person. And so he drops out of Yale in 1980, and for the next 25 years, lives as an undocumented migrant in New York. And over that time, he's involved in a huge number of activities for social justice. It is the 1980s in New York, so this is during the height of the AIDS epidemic, and Colin was deeply involved in various kinds of rights actions and, you know, in welfare people. And so, and he's doing all of this while at the same time being undocumented and trying to navigate a life of his own. And he becomes a really important community builder, a resource for people across different things, not just around HIV and sexuality rights, but also as a writer. When he finally gets his green card in, I think it was 2006 or 7, he decides, 2006, and he says to me, you know, now that I have my green card, you know, the first thing I want to do is move back to Trinidad. So he moves back to Trinidad, and there he becomes really the most visible face of a queer person on the island. He co-founds a group called CAISO, Coalition Advocating Inclusion for Sexual Orientation, which this long name was a specific reference to something happening politically at the time. But, you know, Colin then writes about his life in the newspaper. He becomes a national columnist and just becomes a really important figure. I started writing about Colin or thinking about the work he's done there maybe, I guess, around 2000. I think I met him in 2007. Yeah. And so after all of that, he unfortunately, after living through all of this, he unfortunately falls ill with colon cancer, and he passes away in 2021, just before he turns 60. And so he is the subject of the third chapter of the book, which for me was just really important in telling the story of his advocacy work in Trinidad. It's really about CAISO, the organization, and tells the story of how it's formed. And as I was telling this story, it struck me, you know, Colin was really, had become a really important mentoring figure for younger activists, not just in Trinidad and not just in the region, but also across the world. And what also was striking about Colin is that a very typical line that many gay activists will say is to talk about how their communities are homophobic. So even when teaching, like I'll be teaching a group of students and you'll hear things like when people are introducing themselves or, you know, I'm Jamaican and every Jamaican, you know, my culture is therefore homophobic. And so you'll go around the room and people will have this kind of flats and characterization of their spaces. And Colin was fairly unique in not doing that. He was someone who, and perhaps this is partly because of his long exile away from Trinidad, you know, you learn to, you love that place you've left more than perhaps when you were kind of in it. So he was someone who was all not just really fond of being Trinidadian, but made a real effort to have dialogue rather than to just confront others. So politically, his strategy was about nation building. He would call himself a Trinidadian nationalist. And so there was something different that he was doing. And so here was a way to think about the different ideas of what a nation could be by putting these two, Eric Williams and Colin Robinson, conversation with each other. What would it mean? What was their, how do we think about their sometimes similar and many times contrasting ideas about what a Caribbean nation is and could be? And so that's why I felt this engagement, like the father and the godfather. I mean, there was so much in that chapter. And as I, the more I wrote, the more interested I became also in ideas around productivity and discipline. You know, I talk about the watchwords of Trinidad, discipline, tolerance, production. You know, these are all words that are about managing people. These are all words about like making them work hard. And a lot of this was autobiographical too, because I felt like I was born and I learned what I had to do in life was work hard. And so, I mean, I went back to my old school in Trinidad and I was like, oh God, there's that sign that that is in the book about, you know, basically your duty is to be a hard worker. And it's so tied to our histories of slavery and indentureship. But for me, you know, Colin was, and those were echoes of Eric Williams's vision. You know, a lot of his early speeches were about, in his Youth to the Nation speech, it was about, you know, you all have to work hard. You have to produce. It was all about, you know, proving your humanity through production. And there was a different way to think about a future in which pleasure and well-being and not production and not the economy are primary. And so that's the kind of landscape of ideas that I hoped to map, at least, in putting those two figures in dialogue with each other.
I really thought that was brilliant. And one of the things in particular I found interesting is one of the things which seems to bind the two of them together is what you call a kind of specter, or the thing that in some ways they might both be thought of as nationalists, but in other ways they might both be thought of as anti-colonial nationalists. And so what I found to be probably my favorite part of the book was where you write about how, this is maybe particularly in Colin's case, so there's a bit of a shift where previously, where you might have the non-white bestial homosexual might once have been the target of a kind of colonial civilizing mission. Now, with the relative normalization of particularly white male homosexuality in the global north, there's a new kind of animal which has been produced, which is the non-white heterosexual homophobe. And that has been the target of a lot of gay internationalism, as it were. That was the thing I found most interesting about the book, personally. I would love if you could just speak a bit more towards that specific point.
Yeah, there's this kind of quick shift that happened as, you know, built on decades of civil rights action, there was this relatively quick ascension in legislation and so on of same-sex rights, but we're really about securing the rights and well-being of white, wealthy white people in particular. You know, so the first court case that goes to the Supreme Court, which produces the legalization of same-sex marriage, is by one of the wealthiest queer white women in the country. And that tells you a lot about the kinds of why things move so quickly. Like, it was a very relative, considering decades and decades of fighting for Black civil rights in North America, campaigns by around same-sex move pretty, pretty quickly. And at the same time, so as homosexuality became quite normalized in global North countries, there was simultaneous with it this kind of shift. So now that the homosexual was no longer the beast, there was a new victim in the global South, like alongside the kind of suffering woman, third world woman, there was now a suffering queer subject. And the new beast was no longer the gay person, particularly any kinds of signs of queer sexual beings in the global South, but it was now the homophobe. And so, you know, the most kind of visible examples that people would keep referring to would be Mugabe in Zimbabwe. You know, it's really easy to find anti-homosexual discourse among politicians in the global South. But, you know, historically, one can find that now in the U.S., like now that, you know, with the MAGA movement and so on, there's a new rise in homophobic discourse. But something had switched. And there was a way now in which the beast was in the global South was no longer this beckoning gay figure, but it was this punishing, homophobic, and violent, always violent figure. And so both allowed for the same kind of entry of the hand of the civilizing global North. So if before the normalization of homosexuality in the global North countries, you know, the global North countries had to intervene to fight against homosexuality, produce like good heterosexual citizens and civilized people. Now it was about like the animal behavior of homophobes, but it was achieving the same thing. It was always, always still about the intervention of global North states into global South for the purpose of civilizing the population. So, you know, there was this kind of quick switch, and in some ways nothing had changed, because it was still premised on the idea that that human progression meant that global South peoples had to adopt and mimic those in cultures in the global North.
I thought that was a really, really powerful part of the book. but yeah, just to actually take a bit of a slight shift, actually. So what's, I think, really interesting about the book is that in the first couple of chapters, you set out in a lot of detail, using a lot of different examples, the way in which people in the Caribbean or non-white people in the Caribbean have been animalized or seen to be animal, and how this is inflected with the politics around sexuality. But in the final two chapters of the book, I feel that there's a bit of a shift towards A, contemporary art practice, including your own, but B, towards this kind of question, which basically looks to say, well, we refuse the burden of proof of having to prove ourselves as human being. We are animal, so what? So I felt that was a really interesting kind of shift, and I think maybe even arguably a controversial one in terms of the literature. And so I was wondering if you could just talk us a bit more about that.
Been controversial. It's really interesting because, you know, the group is engaged with a variety of disciplines. So, you know, I've had lots of conversations, you know, in Caribbean studies, in which like the animal question has been really kind of troubling. Like, what do you mean we animal? Because in fact, that has been used so violently over time. I mean, to give you a really mundane example of this history, one Christmas, my brother my parents live in Canada, and my brother visits, and he comes with a little dog, a very tiny little dog. And, you know, I think it's intended as a present for my parents, but they're horrified that, to bring this animal into the house because in Trinidad, you know, animals were kept outside. There had to be a kind of distance between the human and animal. And you see a lot of those anxieties being replayed. In another essay, I talk about a fellow scholar who is deeply, deeply anxious that in Montreal, it's really common to see people bring their dogs to restaurants. And, you know, people are really outraged by that proximity because it does feel like it feels so visceral because for even centuries, there's been this onus put upon people to prove themselves human, not animal. And to have any kind of intimate proximity to an animal would seem to undermine that. So, you know, I felt in the literature, we were still caught in this trap of proving ourselves human. And I wondered, what if that was in the root? You know, I talk about dress codes in the book. That's a really compelling example of the ways in which governments are still executing this demand on their subjects to be human. I mean, it's quite ridiculous, the kinds of long lists, very deeply gendered, you know, a long list about what men can wear, what women can wear, to access basic government services. And it's utterly ridiculous, but it's premised on this idea that especially poor people, because these signs are really just meant are targeted against poorer populations in those countries. Like the demand, like to get access to your government services, first you have to show up looking like a civilized person, not like you. You know, you dress up to do these things. And so there's this long, long history of people feeling anxious about having to prove their humanity, to show themselves that they're not animals. And I thought, well, what if instead of constantly proving our humanity, we recognize our animality? You know, how would that shift things? I mean, for me, the most important shift, it is no longer, we're not measuring ourselves against a set of conditions that were developed in the colonial era and which continue now. There's something that, you know, just undermines that kind of enduring power of colonial discourse. And so that's why in chapter 4, in thinking about the artwork of my friend Kelly Sinopa-Marie, and, you know, thinking about the mythologies of cannibalism, and then in my own arts practice, it's about, and it has been increasingly about undermining that line. You know, we've spent so much time saying, like, we're on the side of the human, like, you know, respect us, give us access to services, give us, see us as people. You know, there's been this 500 years of begging to be seen as people. What if we didn't care? What if, you know, in many ways, again, I've referenced Carnival a couple of times. I'm not even a scholar of Carnival, but I can appreciate Carnival as this really politically powerful moment in which people's rabid sexuality is seen as a kind of like animal freeness, like taking over the street, you know, dancing with whoever, dancing in whatever way, dancing sexually is a really, really strong kind of resistance and response to decades of insistence on discipline. And so I feel, particularly in sexuality studies, where so much of the conversation has been about what are the citizenship, proving gay people are citizens. What are the other routes toward well-being that were not premised on the same kind of demand to prove oneself human? And the second part of that is, you know, simply as an environmentalist and living in an unfolding global ecological crisis, it is a practical need that we become to see ourselves as deeply implicated in the loss of other species and deeply tied to the well-being of other species. And so that was another part of it, which isn't really developed in the book, but really it signs toward.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to ask as well, was just the question about what the kind of contemporary political ramifications of thinking about this are. And again, particularly in the Caribbean as well, where the ecological crisis is maybe, say, unevenly felt in the Caribbean compared to some parts of the global north as well.
I mean, I think there are lots of implications. They're felt. I feel them in the academy. You mentioned earlier on that, you know, most of the case studies in the Caribbean tend to be from the point of view of what's called the middle class in the Caribbean, was a little bit higher than the middle class. And I can say that's true. Like, as an academic, you know, it's really rare to meet someone else who isn't from that kind of background. And it really dictates how people see things. So there's a lot of possibilities that I think get overlooked, a lot of things that are going on outside that space that become underappreciated. And so that's why I spend so much time calling attention to, you know, things that go on in the villages, because it's one of the sites in which I still think there are possible hopeful ramifications. One of them, I mean, just around gender identity. I talk in the book a lot about not feeling the pressures of gender growing up. You know, I was a kid who, you know, loved the film Xanadu soundtrack. Like, I had, you know, Olivia Newton-John's like roller skating Xanadu songs all the time. I was someone whose sort of like best buddy was a Miss Piggy doll. I loved dressing up. I was not dressing up like in crossing boundaries, but not like gender boundaries. Like, that was not sort of what I did as a kid, but I was obsessed with coordinating my outfits from a very young age. I was doing all of these things that really in the city spaces, people I know of my own generation would be punished for. And not just even the cities. I had a at one point, doing research and organizing for the book, I had a white Canadian research assistant who was then, I must have been 21 or 22. And as he was reading those parts of the book, he's like, wow, I got in so much trouble when I did anything that might be read as like not behavior of a boy. And I can't really think of a single time that happened. I was punished in the same way when I was growing up. Like, I can't think of it at all. And I think that's largely because the space I grew up in, I mean, there's a number of reasons, but one of them is that it fell a little bit out of the gaze of the state. So it gives us a kind of idea of what kinds of other futures are possible outside of the spaces that we're prone to looking at, and what might be going on in those spaces that fall outside the gaze of the state, that fall out of the gaze of scholars, and that also are not just simply measuring ourselves against as an established normative model. Like, a lot of the organizing in the Global South has tended to mimic what was going on in the Global North. I worked briefly for the World Bank, my job just in the year before I became a professor was around imagining what the bank might do to advance sexuality rights. And I always got into big fights with my boss, who thought like the future was building gay villages in Africa. You know, taking the model of the metropolitan kind of sense of like, you know, Soho in London, or, you know, Christopher Street and Stonewall in the New York. And that's what was needed, like, a, you know, to build kind of make pride parades and do the kinds of activities that were set up. But maybe there's something else. Maybe there are other things to do. And particularly when you look at some of the ways in which, I mean, the Caribbean has so many rich examples of how queer people find ways to exercise their desires, to form relationships, to have happy existences or relatively happy existences in the face of all of this pressure to do something else, on the face of all of the actions that might be punitive, I think there's something that holds a great deal of implications for us, that maybe there are other kinds of ways to strategize. And it's also why I value the work of Colin Robinson so much. Sometimes you need, you know, I think not even sometimes, you need kind of both things. Like in Trinidad, there was a, and I talk about this in the book, there had been a great debate about the importance of getting rid of the anti-sodomy laws. It had not really been a priority for local activists because it was a law that was not implemented. So people sort of thought, like, you know, there are just more important things on our agenda than getting rid of the law, of decriminalizing sodomy. But Jason Jones, who lives in the UK now, was really adamant about taking on the government to get rid of the anti-sodomy law, and he was successful. And, you know, what is really fascinating is that it really did make a difference in ways that I think people like Colin underestimated. Like, they weren't concerned about a law that wasn't being implemented. But in fact, the law was doing a lot, even if it wasn't being implemented. So when Jason's case was successful, I mean, the government is still trying to appeal it. I mean, and it's also outrageous that the highest court in Trinidad threw out the sodomy law, and now the Trinidadian government is trying to get the British courts to overrule the highest Trinidadian courts in the kind of most absurd kind of colonial replay. But it was really important. So it wasn't that Jason's efforts were not important. I mean, I think many local activists, including Colin at the time, did not see it as a fruitful endeavor. But what you found that you needed both things. You needed the kinds of imaginations of sexual rights advocacy and a different way of thinking about well-being of queer people other than, you know, the ones that were already set before. And you also maybe needed to borrow some of the things of other kinds of advocacy groups. Like, it did make a difference when that law was struck. You know, public pride parades were held for the first time. And you felt it in just the way people then treated each other. I had gone to Trinidad with my then partner in 2008. And it was such a horrifying experience all the time. I mean, horrifying is maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but it was really tough. It was tough with the family. It was tough to circulate as a couple in spaces. And, you know, he in particular really hated it. And then when I returned 10 years later, after the law had been struck down, but with just a friend, we were read from the time we got off the plane as a couple. And the difference was so, you know, was remarkable from dealing with customs. I remember the first time I had gone with my actual partner, customs was really denigrating toward, you know, was really apprehensive about it, was really, you know, interrogating us. And we were just like two people traveling because that's what you did. There was no advantage to presenting yourself as a couple to go through customs. But when I went the second time with just someone who was just happened to be my friend, but was male, and we were read immediately as a gay couple, they were like talking to each other across. I mean, we went to separate booths, and one said to the other, like, oh, aren't they staying at the same place? Like, they shouted across the room. And then, you know, my aunt, who's very, like, you know, warm and loving to pick us up. And, you know, everywhere we circulated, we sort of received warmth. And, you know, I was quite pissed off because I thought, like, the wrong timing, guys. Like, this was supposed to be when I was here with my actual partner. So, but it was really remarkable how much things had changed. And I wrote about that experience for the local newspaper about this kind of tremendous shift. And I had learned that there were I got all of this feedback from people who felt really happy to have that kind of story in the paper, and they were just been more and more stories. So, you know, there are multiple sites of action in politics and policy, And I just want to see an expansion of them rather than saying like, okay, everything has to be an indigenous model or, you know, every global north model is a bad model. But it's about being having a more expansive imagination of our futures.
Right. Well, I think on that note, then, we've taken up a lot of your time, and that seems like a really good time to segue into our final traditional question here at New Books Network, which is, so what are you working on now? Where is this journey taking you?
So there are a couple of things. One, as a researcher, one of the things that I'm thinking and writing about following this call to recognize our animality is thinking about how different species deal with their own crises. So I've been studying particularly animal and plant species in the Caribbean. Some of that will come out in my artwork and some in writing. I'm talking to you from Washington, D.C., where in 2025, in June 25, I will open the exhibition Nature's Wild, which brings together my own artwork and collaborative artworks around the themes of the book. And so I've been preparing those artworks alongside doing new research that takes up from that question about, or from that demand to claim our animality. You know, in a very kind of practical way, like asking the question, you know, everyone is thinking about our unfolding ecological crisis. And one of the ways I'm entering into that conversation is thinking about, well, how did other species deal with this? So I had begun with this flower species named Ixora cochineea, which people may know as jungle flame or other names in the Caribbean. It's a flower that migrated from India with indentured servants. And then the other species I've been looking at is chickens. So that's the kind of work I'm doing as a kind of follow-up to the book. And of course, the art project is the major activity.
Those both sound like really, really great projects, and I'm really looking forward to hopefully seeing the exhibition one day in June 2025. But yeah, I just wanted to say thank you so much for being on the show today, and I really, really enjoyed getting the chance to talk to you, and I'm sure all of our listeners found the discussion really interesting.
Well, thank you so much. Those were really great questions, and I really appreciate your taking the time to think and talk through some of the book's ideas.
The pleasure was all mine. But yeah, thank you. Take care. I really hope you have a good day.
Thank you.